For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore. And as always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. Kent, what's up?
Shall we say, as usual, usually I fight back against, I don't know. I was on vacation last week.
You were.
And so it's not as always, as most of the time.
As most of the time. And last week was the final episode. I kind of decided at random.
Okay.
That 27 episodes was enough for a season.
Sure.
So
I don't know anything else in history that's had 27 episodes in a season.
I think you do. You actually sent me a show that did have 27 episodes in a season. It was Grey's Anatomy. Grey's Anatomy season two.
Yeah. 27 episodes.
So that was one.
No reruns that year.
No reruns that year. So either way, 27 episodes and a couple special episodes as well.
So I've been gone.
Yes.
And disconnected from the news. What's been up? I haven't reconnected in the last couple of weeks. Wanted to come in fresh. And I feel like everything's been good, right? I mean, when I go away.
Nothing terrible happened while you were gone.
All right.
Nothing. I mean, unless you count the largest hate gathering in the history of the United States. As bad.
Back up.
That happened. So we did a special episode while you were gone. Our final episode of the season actually ended up being a commentary on what happened in Charlottesville. But just a really good season all around. Lots of different conversations from Muslim America to LGBT plus in America to immigration reform to rape culture to women in the workplace, the Women's March. And we had a lot of different conversations. Science. Re-examining science, looking at climate change, just really good, high-caliber guests came on. And our season was really hodgepodge, but we did a good job. We kind of got our footing after a kind of shaky first season, did good with the first season, but the second season kind of came into our own. This particular season, so now we're getting into season three. This is season three, episode one.
This is the one where it gets good.
This is the one you've been waiting for. No, all of them have been good, but with this season, one of the things that I decided to do, one of the things that we've decided to do, when I say we, I really still mean I, is we've decided to do more series and not disconnected series. So last season we did Muslim in America. We did that a few times, but they weren't back-to-back episodes. So this season we're striving to do a few episodes that are back-to-back-to-back. And so we're starting off this season with a series called Divided States of America. It's a three-week series, and we're starting off this week with Why I'm Conservative. The next week we will do a panel called Why I'm Liberal, and then the final week we'll bring back people from both of those panels to talk about moving beyond identity politics. So that's going to be the first series that we do in this particular season, and we're going to start off by reading the bios of the people that are here. And actually, one of our panelists is not here just yet. I think he just pulled up.
Something on the web about series called Divided States of America.
That would be my phone going off for some reason. I guess Siri started talking. Anyhow, so we're going to go ahead and read the bios. First up, we have Mr. Justin Imers. Justin Imers is a theologian, social worker, and chaplain. He possesses a Bachelor of Science in Biblical Studies with a minor in Biblical Languages and a Master of Arts in Theological Studies, which focuses in epistemology and bibliology. He is also the primary writer and thinker for thenerdytheologian.com. Justin currently works for the state government. Justin believes that conservatism is better gauged to run the country, as the true goal of conservatism is supposed to be the reduction in government power and control over the lives of the populace. Justin, thank you so much for being here once he gets here. And I thought that was him, but it's actually Dave, the owner of Podcast Detroit, who just pulled up. Next up in studio with us is Mr. Daryl McCullough.
Let it be said, Justin and Dave look nothing alike.
They look nothing alike. Okay. Daryl McCullough is a self-published author, award-winning independent filmmaker, founder of the National Podcast Power Conference, which I will be speaking at this year, and the co-creator and host of the Full Circle Podcast Show. He received his bachelor's in business management from Eastern Michigan University. Daryl believes a conservative route is the best route, as he sees conservative governmental officials having standards in their life, thus they have standards in the way they run the country. Daryl, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And last but not least, on the Skype line, we have Mr. Joe Milligan calling all the way from Puerto Rico. Joe serves as the executive vice president of you're going to have to pronounce this for me. Is it Fundación?
That's Fundación Libertad, which is basically Liberty Foundation in English, but it just sounds so much cooler in Spanish.
It does. I'm going to say it in English, though, because that's the American language, is English. No, pronounce it again for me. Fundación?
Fundación Libertad.
Fundación Libertad. Okay, a not-for-profit policy think tank based in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that he co-founded with the mission of lifting Puerto Rico into the top 10 on the World Bank's Doing Business Index. He is a contributing writer for Think Freely Media Latino and a policy advisor to the Heartland Institute. Additionally, his work has been featured in such prominent outlets as The Wall Street Journal, The Hill, and Caribbean Business, among others. A native of Michigan, Joseph attended Oakland University and Rochester College. Joe believes the conservative values of freedom and self-government are essential for humanity to pursue our passions and live the most fulfilling lives possible. Joe, thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate being on.
I think it would be a great time to tell Joe, as well as Calvin and the audience, that of all of the U.S. territories, Puerto Rico is my favorite.
And okay, why?
Glad you asked.
Okay.
Puerto Rico is the homeland of a lovely couple in their 60s named Luis and Luz Miranda.
Okay.
They emigrated in the 1970s, I believe, where they learned English, not knowing a word of English, while Luis studied for his doctorate simultaneously while learning English in the 1970s.
Okay.
Think about going to college for a doctorate in the United States while learning the language it's being presented in. Very impressive.
Yes.
Their son, Lynn, wrote Hamilton. Doom! Bam!
There's a Hamilton reference.
That's
okay.
It. I just had to go over the hump.
Okay. So there it is in season. Okay. So we'll continue that trend in this season as well. You will always work in a Hamilton reference somehow into each episode. This episode is Why I'm Conservative. And we have three conservatives in the room. And again, for those of you who have listened to the show, you know that the show tends to be more debate back and forth, people on different sides of an equation. We'll do that 2 weeks from now when we have Moving Beyond Identity Politics and we bring people from both of these panels in. But I wanted to get a positive look of each particular group's positioning. Because normally when we talk about politics, we couch our politics in what we are against, rather than what are the distinctives of our particular political point of view. So that being said, I wanted to bring people in who are conservative to talk about the distinctives of conservatism. And I have people coming in next week who are liberal, who will talk about the distinctives of liberalism as well. So not so much debate on this particular panel that I see coming. There could be some slight differences in opinion, but this won't be as much of a debate. But either way, this first question, the first question, what is the purpose of government or the role of government in the conservative viewpoint? What is the purpose and role of government? Anybody can go. I'll say, Daryl, you should go.
Well, I look at government as, for lack of a better word, control. It controls the certain way that the ways that we're supposed to do certain things. I believe government deals with standards, principles, and those are things that are going to go accordingly to the masses.
Okay. Joe, what about you? What's the purpose of government?
Yeah, I think, you know, quite simply, the role of government is to safeguard our rights, our natural rights as human beings, and provide a system of rule of law, a court system to enforce contracts and civil suits and protection of private property. When you make an investment, when you take a risk, you have the assurance of the government that is going to be protected. And otherwise, to stand aside and allow people to live their lives as freely as possible. Because, you know, and Daryl used the word, control. I would throw the word coercion in there. You know, everything the government does comes with an implied threat of force.
Hey, Joe, you got muffled there. You got muffled there for a second. Joe?
Yeah.
You got really muffled there for a second. Can you repeat that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was having a little hard time hearing you there. Well, I was saying that everything that the government does comes with an implied threat of force. So we should really be limiting government only to those things that are worth using that aggression towards, and not simply frivolous laws and regulations and so on and so forth. So that's where I see the role of government coming in.
Okay. Justin, how about you?
Well, purpose of government to me is pretty much the preamble of the Constitution. I mean, it kind of states it right there that it's there to for the general defense of the American populace. It's there for protection of the posterity of the land, for the people. It's a government is a guardian, okay? But it's a guardian against people who would be aggressive against the peoples of the United States. So that's defense militarily. That's defense dealing with domestic threats. But that isn't necessarily any and every social aspect in the world. I think that when you try to regulate societal aspects of a culture, what you end up doing is creating a totalitarian system that is bound to corruption. Being a person that works in government, I can attest to that firsthand. And I'm not going to get into details because if I did, I would lose my job. But all I can say is there is no incentive for government to do better.
Okay.
Especially when you're talking about the bureaucratic area. So my job is not – I'm not voted in to office. My supervisor, none of those people are voted into office. Those are people who've been on the job for 40 years through multiple folks.
Changes in government.
Changes
right.
in government.
Yeah. Republican and Democratic governors.
Yep. So, I mean, they're not voted for. They don't get fired if they don't do a good job.
Okay.
You know, so that's the danger, that's the risk that you run in giving government power. And in my mind, there we have way too much historical evidence showing us that government and power is generally a bad thing. That's how a lot of the atrocities, the human rights violations of the 20th century occurred.
Okay. Let's move on.
The American economic system is a modified form of pure capitalism, And this was most famously expressed by Adam Smith, father of, you know, considered the father of capitalism. And he wrote famously in his book, The Wealth of Nations, quote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker." He left out the candlestick maker. Anyone?
He did.
Okay. "The butcher, the brewer, or the baker, that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." Unquote. With this basic idea of capitalism in view, what's the role of business and our economic system in American society?
Joe, why don't you go first on that, since you can't see everybody in the room and the body language and everything.
Yeah.
Why don't you go first?
You know, we talk about self-interest, and this sort of led into a lot of the ideas of objectivism and Ayn Rand sort of philosophies that come off as very selfish or greedy. But the reality is that capitalism or this system of private property, rule of law, deregulation, a government that stands aside and allows people to pursue their interests has led to a decimation of extreme poverty worldwide in the last 30 years to the tune of some, I mean, don't quote me on something, but it's right around something like 80% of extreme poverty has been eliminated worldwide in the last 30 years. And this is for no other reason than the advancement of free market capitalism or something close to it. I wouldn't call, you know, China a free market capitalist economy, but, you know, it's making advances in that direction. Of course, there was another event that took place in the last 30 years that greatly expanded capitalism. It was the fall of the Soviet Union as well. And these sort of things have led to human flourishing on a level that we've never seen in the history of humanity. And so it's not just the, hey, let me pursue my own self-interest and advance my life. I'm a capitalist because it's what's best for the poor. I'm a capitalist because I can look very clearly at data and what I see around me with my own eyes and watch as poverty just gets eliminated at an incredibly rapid rate when markets open up and governments maintain a strong protection of private property and so forth. So the role of business and capitalism in society as I see it, really capitalism, what we're talking about is just allowing people to do as they please within the sphere of commerce. So the role of allowing people to do what they please, I think it's the natural state of things, and it should be so.
Okay. Justin or Daryl?
Well, I mean, it's been a really long time since America's been a pure capitalism, a capitalist economy. Again, being someone working in government, I know that a lot of the regulations that are in place that kind of hamstring corporations. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Let me ask you this. What year was it that you think America was last a purely capitalist nation? I have a year in my mind. I want to see if it's the same one you've got.
For me, it's probably close to 1930.
I was going
to
say 1933.
Yeah.
Because Roosevelt was elected and put in the New Deal, which put the social safety net in place and ensured that a whole lot – that the old and the sick wouldn't die, which was kind of the end of pure capitalism.
Okay. That's when Medicaid came in, right?
Medicaid was in the 60s.
Medicare.
Yeah.
So Medicare became
– well, not Medicare. It was Social Security.
Okay.
Social in the 30s.
Okay. All right.
Jobs programs.
Got
welfare.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, I work in the welfare sector.
Okay.
So that's we'll talk about this later.
Justin's going to keep dropping small clues as to who he works for in the state.
I keep working for it, okay? But it's all I will say with regard to the social welfare programs of this country is that they're completely totally a waste of money. They measure the wrong things on a consistent basis, the metrics and the measurables that they use are completely and totally skewed to irrelevant and inconsistent data points that are completely and totally pointless to what is actually going to assist and help poor people. So that's all I'll say about that. But okay. I do think that pure capitalism as a system of economy, while great in theory, has a tendency to think a little too well of human beings. So the economic system has to have a checks and balances, I think, with government. And just like, you know, government has to have a checks and balances with businesses and the people. I think there's some of that going on right now mm-hmm. in the way that our economy is run. Some of it a little bit too much on the side of government. I think there's a little bit too much regulation hamstringing corporations in a lot of ways. But it's one of those things where pure capitalism did not lead to the era of the 1950s that most conservatives consider the bygone era. Okay, it's like 1953 to 1957, which most conservatives would say those were the good old days. Okay, pure capitalism didn't lead us there. It was a combination of social construction and capitalism. That's what got us to that point that we liked to be at, supposedly, for conservatives.
Well, I hear you on the conservative side of things in terms of, you know, look, pure capitalism doesn't exist, but the form of capitalism that we do have, it has its issues, but it could use some more checks and balances. And I hear a lot of conservatives say that, and that's fair, and I think that's a good thought on it. But I don't find many conservatives who say, you know what, capitalism has some major issues that need to be examined. So let's try some socialist policies. You know what, why don't we try some communist policies? It's very conservatives seem to be staunchly capitalist, at least in terms of their economic outlook.
That's because all communist ideas are bad ideas.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's just the truth. Communist ideas are
communist economic ideas. We're talking about
communist economic ideas. Yeah, but you can't separate the communist economic idea from the communist totalitarianism. It's the only way it works. Okay, communism as a system of economy is inherently oppressive.
Okay.
Period.
All right.
And it's shown that in the sense that those countries that have been communist or socialist. Look at Venezuela right now. It has been shown time and time again that system of government does not work.
Okay. Fair
so enough. That's why conservatives rail so hard against it is because it's I don't know how many times you have to prove something doesn't work before people start to get it. History proves it doesn't work.
Daryl, how about you?
Well, you gentlemen definitely have more knowledge on this subject than I do. I don't want to comment just for the sake of commenting. Good points. I appreciate both sides.
That's fair. So let's move on from the economy here. And for those of you who are expecting deep dives into all of these, we could do an entire episode on all of these questions that we're asking, and we probably will in the future. But moving the conversation forward, the Trump administration most recently attempted to repeal and replace the previous administration's Affordable Health Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare. They failed to get the votes to do this. They have the majority in the House, in the Senate, failed to get the votes. That's neither here nor there. What role should government play in health care?
I guess I'll go first this time. Since I none.
The government should have no. Okay, so no. Go on,
Daryl.
Why?
The reason for that is because it is the government's involvement in the first place that created the poisonous healthcare system we had previously, and that was when it allowed insurance companies to monopolize markets by restricting insurance companies to states. What it did was it restricted the ability of those insurance companies to compete with one another, okay, which competition drives down prices. That's capitalism 101. And when you restrict the free market in any – especially in that fashion and you create these – you create 50 mini markets essentially. You give people no place to go, and the insurance companies can do whatever they please. ACA was nothing but a play to the insurance companies. Insurance companies are making money hand over fist right now because of ACA. It's not helping. The reality of it is all we've done is feed a direct line of unlimited cash flow to the insurance companies. It's all we've done. We've only fed the beast we were trying to starve. And the only way you beat these guys is by lifting all of the rules and regulations, sitting back and saying, have fun. But still keeping laws like insider trader laws.
Not all the rules and regulations.
Those rules and regulations with regard to like insider trading and that kind of thing, that just keeps them from being able to meet in a room and all go, okay, these are our prices. We're setting our own prices and we're not going to undercut each other, right? So that allows the insurance companies to create a monopoly in and of itself, and that's something that's illegal. 1935 was when that law was passed.
And I get what you're saying here. It sounds to me and in a very real sense, I know that you are talking about the same thing I'm about to mention. It sounds like you're talking about Wall Street. Like how do we regulate companies on Wall Street? How do we drive competition between each other? We're talking about healthcare here, and this is where I think people, both conservative and liberal, get very, very frustrated because we're talking about people's lives here. Like grandma's got cancer. Like I don't want to be talking about insurance companies fighting with each other over the price of cancer medicine. I want you to get, you know, to help grandma get better. And I know that I know that you can't take the price out of things. Things cost money, right? But the fact of the matter is, when we're talking about government being removed from the situation, creating the situation in the first place, all those kinds of deals. Will government being removed from the healthcare debate or healthcare industry, because that's what it is at this point, a business, will that solve the problem or will that create a Wild West scenario?
Well, I mean, even the Wild West wasn't really the Wild West. So it's one of those things where I think that number one, we're not going to know until we try, because the reality of it is the healthcare system in this country has never really been no holds barred capitalist. I mean, the hospitals and medical providers of this country have been inflating prices of their products. I mean, it costs $130. They charge you $130 for an IV. Okay. Do you know how much it costs to manufacture something like that? 25 cents.
It's like getting Nikes.
Okay.
Nikes take 25 cents worth of material.
It's 130. It's 100, but we're talking about insurance here.
Right.
Okay. And we're talking about the reason that they can conflate the price that high is because we've allowed insurance companies to get away with murder, and we've allowed medical providers to get away with murder by protecting them with government regulations. See, some of these regulations that we deem as protections for the citizen is actually protections for the insurance company and the medical provider, not for the citizen.
Okay.
So the more with medical care, the more restrictions you put in place, the reality of it is the more restrictions you put in place with regard to how free the market can be with healthcare, the more difficult you make it for the average person to get good medical care, and social medical doesn't
okay.
work.
I want to get some other perspectives in this as well. Daryl, Joe, thoughts?
Well, from my perspective, I worked for a company over 20 years, but during that time, I ended up quitting and doing some contract work. And when I did that, I ended up having to pay $800 a month for insurance. And I also was in contact with some people who went bankrupt because of their medical bills. And it made me think, okay, something's wrong here. It was scary. And I also got overtime during that period. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm just got the money coming in and I see what I'm getting paid. They forgot to take the insurance out and they had to double up on the next month. So that's $1,600 out of something's wrong. So, that's when I really started. I mean, I was pampered for many, many years. I didn't know how much I paid for insurance, but during that time I was like, okay, this is very important, especially for, people who are retired. So we got to do something.
Joe?
Yeah, and getting back to the role of government, if, as I see it, it is to safeguard our rights, and if we agree that one of our rights is the right to life, I don't think it's entirely out of bounds for the government to get involved in healthcare. And so from that standpoint, you have to ask the question, is it pragmatic for the government to get involved in healthcare? And I look at some other countries because there's a lot of test tubes in the world where we can figure out what works and what doesn't. I mean, public policy really shouldn't be a guessing game anymore. And socialized medicine, where, to be clear on definitions here, the government owns the hospital, the doctors are on the payroll of the government, so on and so forth, is a pretty clear failure. Single payer, which is something different, which is where the hospital or the doctor's office and so forth are all privately owned, the doctors are all working privately, the bill just gets sent to the government to pay, is something that seems to work okay in some countries. But what I find interesting is that there's an argument that can be made where capitalism can actually be enhanced by government getting involved in healthcare, because you can take someone who has a great idea, they want to strike off on their own, start their own business, take a risk.
Okay. Have you gotten, you're getting muffled again.
Oh, I apologize. I'm in the mountains here in the middle of the island, so it's probably the signal cutting in. Can you hear me okay now?
Yep, can hear you fine.
So, you know, capitalism could potentially be enhanced by the government getting involved in healthcare. When somebody's trying to take a risk to start a new entrepreneurial endeavor, they may be dissuaded from doing it by the fact that, okay, I've got a young wife, a couple of children, I've got to provide for them, they're all on my insurance through my large corporate employer. I can't just take a risk with their life. I'd be willing to take a risk with my own capital. I'd be willing to take a risk with my energy. But I can't just strike off on my own and start my own endeavor. What if my children get sick? So it could encourage entrepreneurial risk in a certain way. And I'm open to that idea. But, you know, really, I think what it comes down to is what we're talking about, is allocation of resources. And, you know, I wholeheartedly agree with what Justin was talking about with the insurance industry. But, you know, the supply and demand equation needs to be looked at. So the supply is being greatly constrained by government and by regulation and by the American Medical Association. To sort of give you one scenario of how healthcare could work. And I think there's a massive lack of imagination in solving these issues. If I have a sore throat and I know that, okay, this is strep throat, I've had strep throat before, I had it recently, all I need is an antibiotic to wipe this out, I'm a perfectly healthy individual, my buddy's wife is a nurse, I can just go to her, she can look at me and say, yeah, that's just strep throat, it just has all the hallmark symptoms of it, all you need is some penicillin. You can get penicillin, I think, for free at Meijer, but you need a prescription. You need to see an actual doctor to get the prescription. The doctor's going to do an x-ray of your foot because God knows why, and he can charge the insurance company for it, and so on and so forth. So rather than allowing people to get whatever health care they need with whatever means they have, you have to go through these very concise constraints per licensing and regulation and so on and so forth. I myself, in times of financial strain, have gotten my medical attention under the table from individuals who weren't supposed to be doing that, but that was what I could afford. And my alternative was just to sit there and wallow away. So, you know, breaking the law in that instance becomes a moral duty incumbent upon myself. But the supply, there's no shortage of medical supply in America. It's getting that supply into the hands of the people who are demanding it. That's the difficult thing. And if we use some imagination and we quit being so afraid of people getting harmed by bad medical care that we're harming them by not allowing them to get any at all, then I think we can start to solve this problem.
Hey, Joe?
Yeah.
Hey, Joe. This is Kent. Let me ask you a follow up question on something you said about because you drew a pretty distinct line between single payer and socialized medicine, where the hospitals where the medical facilities are government owned and run, and the medical professionals are on government payroll. And you said that is clearly a failure. Would you consider the NHS in the UK to be a failure? Because in all candor, the people that I know who have accessed it and people who have lived there say it is a raging success that the country would not give up for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how the NHS works.
Sure. And as long as we're speculating on that, I've heard similar things myself from some friends of mine who are from the UK. And those friends were in their mid-20s at the time and perfectly healthy and, quite frankly, didn't have a whole lot of experience with the healthcare system. They'd never had a major problem. I think if you look at the situation with Charlie Gard and not being allowed to receive the care he needed and so on and so on, I think it is a failure.
Although
when compared to
the case of Charlie Gard isn't an issue of how we pay for healthcare. It's about that had nothing to do with how we pay for healthcare. That is a situation of whose rights are considered preeminent by the legal system. Is it the parents or the child? No matter how we were going to pay for Charlie's healthcare, it was about are his parents' rights preeminent, or is the child's rights preeminent under their system of laws? That was billed as having something to do with socialized medicine, and it didn't.
So yeah, it had exactly to do with socialized medicine.
That's fine. I disagree with you, but sort of neither here nor there. It's an example I'm throwing out. But it's beside the point if you don't see it that way. We have an example, right here in the United States of socialized medicine versus single payer. You have the VA system versus Medicare, and I think, and again, I shouldn't speculate on how other people, but in what I've seen, Medicare works a heck of a lot better than the VA system.
Absolutely.
So that's a little bit more of a local example.
Yeah, you don't hear about Medicare scandals.
You can hear about fraud and scandals all over the place.
Right.
I don't think any system's going to be perfect, but we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
So we've got, moving on, there's completely from healthcare. There's two hot button issues that conservatives have classically been concerned with, and those are in the moral dimension, and that is homosexuality and rights surrounding it, and access to abortion. This aligns itself pretty closely with the considerations of our dominant religions in the United States. Now that gay marriage is legal in all 50 states because of the Supreme Court decision of two summers ago, and it seems unlikely that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned anywhere in the immediate future, how does a conservative address these matters personally and politically?
Okay, I'll go first on this. You spoke earlier about so I will speak from personal experiences.
Okay.
The feelings that I have are because I've experienced these things. I'll go over here with homosexuality. My brother's gay, and we talk maybe once a year. I'm looked at as the bad guy because everyone's so liberal nowadays. But I have certain standards, and I will respect your standards if you respect my standards. So I'm just not as open-minded in that perspective. Now, but I'm trying. However, it is being crammed down America's throat, I feel, with every television show. There's a gay character. They're forcing you to accept this. And when you push a raccoon, a possum in a corner, they're going to come out scratching. I don't think they're going to go accordingly. Now, I'm going to go over here with abortion. I was probably 20 years old going to college, met a girl. She got pregnant, and she opted for an abortion. And we went through the whole picketing and all that. It was a terrible experience. Most guys, most men, when they're in that type of situation, they think, whoa, I got out of that by the skin of my teeth. It bothered me. It bothers me to this day. I would not wish that upon anyone else. So because of that situation, I'm pro-life, you know, and I recently got connected with my old girlfriend's sisters on Facebook. And immediately when I saw them, I thought, man, you know, I could have a child. We, you know, we will be closer as a family because of that situation. But, you know, it's not for me.
Let me just clarify. I may have missed something. Did you say you're pro-life because pro-lifers made your situation such a nightmare?
No, I'm pro-life because that situation to, for lack of a better word, agree to have an abortion mm-hmm. was, I feel, a bad decision. Okay. If I could go back, I would have that child.
Okay, I just didn't know why we brought up the picketing.
And I've heard he had to cross the picket line.
Oh, okay.
Cross the picket line.
Right.
Okay. So
it's scary.
And,
you know.
Yes.
Thank you for both of those, you know, thank you for being real and honest about those things. The question, though, is, I mean, let's just be honest. At this point, conservatives have lost a culture war on both those issues. Like, gay marriage is legal. You fought, you lost. Abortion, fought, lost. Although I don't know that conservatives really fought Roe v. Wade as hard as they're fighting now when it was originally going before the Supreme Court. But either way, those two issues that conservatives seem to stand on, the moral issues there, are issues that are legal in all 50 states. You can get an abortion, safe and easy access to one, and you can get married to your gay partner if you want to in the United States in any of the 50 states. So given that those things have been lost in the culture, how does a conservative move forward? You have to deal with the fact that these things are legal now. Even if it's not for you personally, politically, how does a conservative move forward on those issues? Do they continue to fight that battle, or do they pivot and move on to something else? Because I know a lot of people will fight trying to get Roe v. Wade overturned. Do you think conservatives are going to try to get the Supreme Court decision for gay marriage in all 50 states overturned as well? Or do you move on to something else like tax reform?
Well, in my mind, these two issues – well, the two issues on a practical level are very different. But on a constitutional basis, I think they're both very similar in the sense that we need to get the judiciary out of the business of legislating from the bench. That is actually not their function. That is not their role. They have been pressing themselves out of that role since the early 1900s, and they need to be – the reality of it is there's checks and balances in place, and if we had had presidents that were worth anything and legislative branches that were worth anything, they would have removed judges from benches who were making rulings where law was being done on the bench.
Can we get a definition? Because I hear this a lot, a definition of legislating from the bench.
Yeah, it's the essential. Okay, gay marriage is now legal in all 50 states. The only body, according to the Constitution, that is capable of making something legal in this country is the legislative branch, not the judiciary. Okay, the fact that the judicial branch can have a say in that, per the Constitution, that's a direct violation of the checks and balances system that the Constitution has in place, and it has that for a reason.
Here's the deal, though. My wife and I, we had some friends over for dinner last night, and we were talking about the Loving case that went before the Supreme Court, right? And she said it's really interesting and sad that people in the type of relationship that I'm in an interracial relationship, can only just now celebrate a 50-year anniversary legally in the United States, right? And I don't want to conflate homosexuality with interracial marriage because they're not the same thing. They're just not. But how they were determined is, right? So I know that you would never tell me, hey, Calvin, I think that because it was legislated from the bench that your marriage to your wife should not have happened that way legally. We're never going to have that conversation if you don't want to get punched in the throat, right? I don't think that you believe that in that sense. So I'm wondering if it is on certain moral issues, and it's fair if you have a moral view on certain things. I know what your moral background is because we come from the same one. But is it legislating from the bench when it is something we disagree with? It's probably a better question. Because I think people legislate from the bench both ways.
And I tend to think that there is a misunderstanding of what it is the Supreme Court did in the summer of 2015. They didn't make gay marriage legal, except, pardon the term, in a backdoor sense. They said that laws forbidding it were unconstitutional. So they said that if you look at a law that allows a person to marry one person but not another person, that's a violation of the 14th Amendment. It didn't touch the issue of whether or not gay marriage is legal. They didn't legislate that. They said this law is unconstitutional, and that's their purpose. Their purpose is to determine whether or not laws are constitutional.
Now, I will grant you, in California, which is arguably, you know, you can go back and forth between Washington and California as to which is the more liberal state. Pacific Northwest, right? But California a few years ago voted on this issue of something around the gay debate, around gay marriage, and the people voted a certain way. And then five Supreme Court justices in the state of California, state of California Supreme Court, overturned that vote of the people. That I would be considered legislating from the bench, because if people vote a certain way and then it is overturned by judges, I do take issue with that on any issue.
Any issue? What if the people of Michigan said black people aren't human and it passed 60-40? It is an issue of some laws, some referenda are simply wrong. The people are wrong. That's what judges are there to say.
Okay, that's fair.
But the people are wrong in accordance to the law, not in accordance to their own interpretation of the law. That's the issue. That's the issue for me, okay? Their job is to make judgments of the law on whether or not it was broken. Their role is not to create new rules. That's not their job. So that's the issue I take. Now, the issue of homosexuality on a personal level, I don't care. In reality, I don't think government should have any role in marriage. I think government has overstepped its bounds there. It has no right to point its nose into that and have anything to say about it. I think that if they want to find some way to make money off of it, like they have, to just make everything a civil union, but to get rid of the marriage aspect of it, it's a word from a bygone era that we no longer really work through anymore. Judeo-Christian belief system in the United States is all but disintegrated. And instead of acting like it hasn't, let's just admit that it has and get rid of the idea of a marriage license. The state has no right to be telling me who I can and cannot marry.
As a reminder to the audience, Justin's blog can be found at thenerdylibertarian.com.
But with regard to the abortion debate, that conversation is far from over.
Okay.
The science is actually really beginning to full steam ahead, make abortionists look really bad. And just within the last 5 to 10 years, I don't think in the next 5 to 10 years that unrestricted abortion paid by the government is going to be happening anywhere in this country.
The government doesn't pay for abortions.
Yes, it does. Medicaid pays for abortions, so the government does pay for abortions.
Medicaid pays for abortions for who?
for anyone on the Medicaid system.
Medicaid does not pay for abortions.
Let's Google that. We'll put a pin in that and come back to that on the second half. As far as I understand, the government does not fund abortions directly or in maybe indirectly. I don't know. But as far as I understand, that's not the case. But let's Joe, you haven't gotten to chime in on this.
Yeah, the sort of traditional libertarian view on marriage that you guys just mentioned, where the government shouldn't have any involvement whatsoever, is one that for the longest time I generally ascribe to. However, the government does license marriage. It is a thing that happens already, and if we were to just today eliminate that and say, okay, government doesn't license marriage anymore, it has no place in marriage, that would affect thousands of laws, or I don't know, countless laws. I'm not going to throw out a number because I don't know how many it would actually affect. But, I mean, there's an actual reason legally when you start talking about private property and these other things that I've mentioned why we do license marriage. So a couple that gets divorced, well, who has possession over what? It's a very difficult legal thing to navigate around. And so there's sort of a reason the government does that. Historically, if you look at it, marriage is a religious ceremony. It's a religious agreement between two people. And that's a pretty inescapable fact about it. But I don't think in any way that relegates marriage to one man and one woman the way a lot of evangelical Christians limit it to, because now you have Christian church denominations that facilitate gay marriage. So how could the state, in its simple acknowledgement of a religious ceremony, okay, you engaged in this religious ceremony, we'll acknowledge it by giving you a license, say that marriage is only between a man and a woman? But there is the issue of definition, because if you're going to license something, you have to define what it is. So I'll grant that to the more social conservatives, that as long as government is involved, there does have to be some definition. And I guess everybody just has their own viewpoint on what that's going to be. Now, as far as the abortion issue goes, again, I believe everyone is endowed by their creator with the right to life, the right to simply be alive. And if that's the case, then we have to determine, okay, where does that life begin? And I've come to the conclusion that it begins at conception. My mother was a nurse, and when she went into the field of nursing back in the 1980s, the point at which a fetus was viable, that they could keep it alive in the case of a premature birth, was, several months into the pregnancy. And it was really considered a living, viable human being at that point in time. And by the time she left the field in 2005, technology had created a situation where the viability of that fetus was scaled way back to only a few months. I'm not sure where it is today. But you can't define a person's life as beginning at the point of the viability of the fetus outside of the womb, because that's greatly dependent upon technology. And I think as technology increases, we're just going to get to the point where we come to the conclusion that life simply begins at conception. And if that's the purpose, that's the point, then the purpose of government being to protect our rights and to protect life, abortion should not be a procedure that's allowed. To get more to the heart of your question, though, which is where conservatives go from here with all of this sort of thing, you could always say that you're losing until you win. And if you look at the trajectory of the abortion issue, social conservatives are completely losing on the marriage issue. Absolutely. When it comes to the abortion issue, I think if you look at abortion laws, unless I'm mistaken, from, let's say, just go back to the early 90s until now, they've gotten more restrictive, not less restrictive. So I'm not sure that conservatives are losing the battle for life.
Yeah, South.
W. Bush facing restrictions on
In the South, it's very difficult to get an abortion. In much of the South, I think there's one active clinic in Alabama. There's, I think, one or two in Mississippi. And those are tall states. So it may be legal in those states, but it might require a five-hour drive.
So let's move forward, and then we'll take a break. Just speaking about the value of human life, let's talk about humans who have been born, who do have value, who are made in the image of God. I believe that was some language that was used earlier by one of our panelists here. But let's talk about illegal immigration and refugee resettlement. That was a major issue for conservatives in the last election. What is a conservative view about the current state of the immigration system in the U.S.? And pause for just a second, because I want to tell a story. A couple days ago, I woke up from a nap, got on Facebook, saw that a friend of mine was going to be in the extreme minority going to a gathering of the Macomb County Republican Women's Coalition. And it was a talk, a very frank talk about what women need to know about Sharia law. And so I sat there with three Muslim women and about 40 white people from Macomb County who were talking about keeping mostly refugees out because we can't vet them. And if we let them in, they're going to rape our women. And this was literally a 5-minute part of this conversation that they were – this presentation this guy gave about the danger of Muslim women raping white women in our towns. And so this was a group of conservative people who were very, very concerned, but had a very stark and what I would consider, frankly, dangerous view of a particular set of people. And I don't want to discount everything they said. There is terrorism in the world, and we've had Muslims on this show and talked about that and addressed those issues. When it comes to illegal immigration and refugee resettlement, what I have heard is basically steeped in fear from the conservative side. Fears of your job being taken away by an illegal immigrant hopping a border fence or tunneling underneath, and possible terrorist attack or rape by refugees who are resettled. Even calling people who are not refugees in order to continue a particular narrative. Case in point, argued with a woman who's running for city council in Sterling Heights, and she told me the brothers who bombed Boston were refugees. And I was like, no, they were naturalized citizens. They were not refugees. They went through the vetting process that you're talking about, regular old coming in through, you know, waited the years, got everything, and then they ended up being terrible people. We're not talking about refugee resettlement or illegal immigration at that point. But that seemed to be this overwhelming conservative view in that room, and it seems to be an overwhelming conservative view that I have run into. Bear in mind, most of that's online, so a lot of people can be very aggressive and keyboard warriors. But what is a conservative view about the current state of the immigration system in the U.S., whether immigrating because you want a job or a better life or because you're running from persecution somewhere? And Joe, we'll have you go first.
Yeah, so I'm probably going to get a little bit of pushback from the other panelists here today on this. To me, the conservative position from a classical perspective is that government shouldn't be restricting cash moving across borders. It shouldn't be restricting goods and services moving across borders. And with that, it shouldn't be restricting human capital moving across borders freely as the market dictates. If people can come here, they can find work, they can carve out a better life for themselves, they should be allowed to do that freely. Getting to the refugee issue a bit more specifically, that's a little bit different, but again, I take the viewpoint of if somebody is willing to sponsor refugees, if a church gets together and say, we'd like to pool our resources together and ensure that we can bring 4 families here, guarantee them a decent quality of life, give them food and shelter and so forth, I don't see why the government shouldn't be doing that. And again, this is an example sometimes of the government making people's lives worse by not allowing them to take someone who's in a terrible, tragic situation in a war zone somewhere and allow them to bring them here. But also, I don't think the government should be saying, okay, let's sponsor these refugees, bring them all over here, give them government housing and so on and so forth, because, you know, why shouldn't they be doing that for someone living in Juarez or Tijuana or wherever else? I don't like the government picking winners and losers in any facet of life, and that includes immigration. But as long as people are willing to facilitate this on a private basis, the government does more harm by not allowing them to improve people's lives than it does good, in my perspective.
Okay. Justin?
Well, I think when it comes to illegal immigration, you're dealing with an issue of people breaking the law. That's far different from being a fetus and being terminated because you're inconvenient. So equating the two, I don't think is right nor fair, because one did absolutely nothing.
Right.
The other broke the law.
Okay.
Of the land that they're coming into. So, not the same.
I didn't say they were the same.
Well, you kind of, you implied they were the same.
That abortion and illegal immigration?
Well, you said they were both, that both abortion.
I said we're talking about life.
We're right. Talking we're about, talking about life.
Yes.
Okay. But we're dealing with two completely different
okay.
circumstances.
Okay. All right. Got it. Okay.
Okay. You know, we're still required to have laws. I mean.
Understood.
From a Judeo-Christian perspective, we're a society built on law and rule. Or the best we could. obviously, human nature sucks inherently, and
yep.
That's all we can do with that. But illegal immigration, so I think it's an issue of if you broke the law, then you need to make your amends for that, just like anybody else. I think in reality, it does more harm to the African American community than anyone by allowing illegals to stay in this country, because a lot of the individuals who are most harmed are people who are low skill workers. The vast majority, a good majority of the individuals that do not graduate from high school in this country are black, because the inner city education system is abysmal. And that's being kind. It's more apocalyptic. It is an absolute travesty and a human rights. I'm not going to go there because that's not what we're talking about. But it's awful. And the reality of it is that the African American community is more hurt by illegal immigration than anybody else. Okay, the people who really make out are the farmers who are going to hire these people for less than, you know, minimum wage because they're not on the record.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, you know, old white dudes. You don't have the people that – so in my opinion, when the Democrats stand up for this, they're really kind of like cutting a part of their constituency out at the knees, because the reality of what they're doing is they're essentially, you know, taking the African American community and saying, "Ah, you're not, you know, you, go ahead and sit back here. This is an important issue of the day," and they're really doing a disservice to the African American community and protecting them from these people who've come into the country illegally. When it comes to refugee resettlement, I don't necessarily have an issue with that. I do think that we're not the world's Red Cross. I don't think we should be in the business of taking all of the country's poor and low-skill workers and bringing them into the country, because that does immeasurable harm to this nation. The immigration policies of this country long before the 1960s and 1970s, when a lot of these immigration laws got changed, was that the only individuals that were allowed in the country were individuals who had something to give to the system, to the economic system. These were people who were doctors and lawyers, or people who were doing jobs, skilled jobs that we needed, that we didn't have enough of, that added to the economy by creating cash flow. And now it's done on a lottery system. It's got nothing to do with what a person can add to the economy, what person can add to the society. It's nothing but random chance. And that's why one of the only things that Trump is doing that I actually support is the merit system that he has, that he wants to in place, is because he wants to look at immigration as an issue of how does this better America? How does this better the nation as a whole? But refugee resettlement, I don't have an issue with it as long as the area that the refugees are coming from is doing something to help. And when it looks – when you come to Syria and Iraq, they're not doing anything. It's the same situation with the Palestinians. If the, all these Arab nations around were so frustrated and angry about the Palestinians not being given their rights, why don't they give them a homeland? Give them a sliver of your own land. Let them live there. Or if they, if you're really upset that Europeans and Americans are making a fuss about refugees being resettled, well, then why don't you take some? Jordan was the only Middle Eastern country other than Israel, that took refugees from the Syria and Iraq conflict. That's it. That's awful.
Okay.
Why are we doing that?
I have a lot to say, but I'm trying to keep everything in a positive light for conservatism, and I think you're doing a darn good job.
Can I push back on that a little bit?
We're out of time to push back. You can push back on the back end because I need Daryl to give some thoughts, and then we're gonna take a break. So, Daryl, your thoughts.
Well, I'll do this real simple.
Crisp and clean. I'm not perfect. If there are 10 bad things, I'm working on one. 9, I'm pretty good, okay? And I'm going over here with this. I have a problem when people steal cable, okay? I'm doing it the legal way. You're doing it the illegal way. So if you have these people coming over here to the great American melting pot and they're here illegally, I have a major problem with that. There are concerns that come with people being here, these people being here. I don't support that.
Okay. Well, I think that it's a good place to stop. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and we will come back and we will talk about some in-house issues for conservatives. So we'll be back in 10. Well, hey, everybody, thanks so much for waiting on the line for us. We're going to – oh, there's a
– you always know when we're back from break.
For real? Jeez. Waited for the bag to open and then pops it right at the microphone. Okay, fine. Whatever. Republicans, I swear to God. No.
The back half of this podcast is brought to you by Diet Verners.
So we kind of talked about the definitions and distinctives on the front end. Kind of, you know, what do conservatives believe? There was a little bit of difference, but still a lot more commonality than differences. This side of the show, we want to talk about more in-house issues. And I want to start off by talking about one of the major issues that I saw. And I think everybody here comes from a religious background. So I think religion played a little bit into this. But one of the major issues with conservatives this election cycle was the seeming abandonment of its moral center in a grab for power. And while there's certainly a difference between Trumpism and conservatism, I will grant that, and classic conservatism, it was not liberals who elected him as their candidate, and it was not liberals who elected him as president. How do you make sense of the election of Donald Trump by the party that claims traditional values, given the things that he's said, given the things that he has refused to say, given the fact that 20 years ago when Bill Clinton was caught in an affair, James Dobson of Focus on the Family said he is morally disqualified from being the president of the United States, to 20 years later, that same man saying, well, we're not voting for a pastor in chief when the pussy-grabbing statements came out. So people who claim to be the moral center and the moral background or backbone, and as you said, Daryl, you know, people who have character, who can lead the country. That's what conservatives have. That seemed to be abandoned in this grab for power. Oh, her emails, or I'm voting on abortion, and so I'll get behind anybody who's against abortion, even if they're the most repugnant person on the planet. People have said that to me. That's not me saying that Trump is personally repugnant. That's people who voted for him saying, even though he's repugnant, I am pro-life, so that's where I'm going. How do you make sense of the election of Donald Trump by a party that claims to be about traditional family values and the moral backbone of this country?
Well,
because I'm a liberal, I don't got to claim him.
Right. I'll.
When we started the show, you were a conservative. That's how long I've been around.
Wow. I'm sorry, but I judge a person by their character. I judge a person by their appearance. And when it comes to a president, I believe he's supposed to look a certain way. He's supposed to walk a certain way and talk a certain way. And Donald Trump was none of those things as far as what I'm looking for in a president. I believe he was married twice, if not three times.
He's on his third marriage.
That strike one. He's just a different kind of guy. However, when you are a conservative, which he's not, I don't believe, but when you are a conservative, you stay on that team. Just as I was so surprised that the Democrats didn't stay on the team. They just abandoned the situation. But regardless,
I'm a little bit lost by what you meant when you said the Democrats abandoned their team.
Meaning you got Bernie Sanders, you got Hillary Clinton, and when Bernie lost, his people stayed with him. They just forget Hillary.
Okay.
I just thought that they would have just said, okay, well, we're just going to go with him, with her.
And to be fair, many of them did. But I heard something today that 12% of Sanders voters not just didn't vote, but voted for Trump.
Mm.
That's news to me. So,
wow.
Okay. All right.
I looked at it like I flipped the negative to a positive. I said, you know what? This man, yes, he's filed bankruptcy several times, but he's a businessman. And I think he's going to run this government like a business, and I'm going to get behind him.
So the Secret Service can no longer afford to protect the President of the United States because of all the trips that he's gone on and the fact that his family is larger and they have to have Secret Service.
Obama did some things too, but go on.
Oh, he's already outspent Obama.
Obama's Secret Service never ran out of money.
His first 3 years, he's already outspent Obama. It took Obama 3 years to get to the amount of money that this businessman has spent and has already pretty much bankrupted the Secret Service. They cannot pay Secret Service agents the overtime they've already worked. This is the stuff that people would flip out about the Detroit school teachers not being paid last year for work that they'd already done. We might not be able to pay you, right? That was a travesty, and a travesty of Democratic policies, right? And so now you have a Republican president, a conservative, the head of the conservative party, or the party that claims to be conservative, right, who is spending crazy, called our last president golfer in chief, and he's golfed more times than any other president at this point in their presidency, and is on par to, no pun intended there, on par to never have his record broken. So, I mean, is this someone who you trust fiscally? Is this someone who the statements that they've made, is someone you can trust to lead our country morally as a conservative? Are those not concerns for you?
Do I trust him anymore? I was definitely behind him in the beginning. It's getting a little difficult to defend him. So I understand your points.
Okay. Justin, Joe?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you acknowledged the fact right off the bat that Trump is not a conservative. You said classical conservative, I think, but I would clarify and say he's just not a conservative of any breed. He's just Donald Trump, and that's that. And, you know, I'm inclined to be a policy guy, not a political guy. And policy is about ideas. Politics is about people and teams. And when it comes to the ideas, I'll support Donald Trump when he does the right things and when he pursues the right ideas, and I'll criticize him when he doesn't do the right things or the right ideas. I didn't support Donald Trump in the election, so I can stand here and hold my hand up and say, don't blame me. And by the way, to your point about Bernie Sanders voters jumping over and voting for Donald Trump, that wasn't the least bit surprising, or at least it shouldn't have been surprising, because from a policy perspective, if we're just talking about ideas, and if you ignore the rhetoric or the volume to which those ideas are conveyed, Donald Trump was a lot closer to Bernie Sanders than he was to any of his fellow Republican contenders in the primary. And Bernie Sanders, from a policy perspective, was a lot closer to Donald Trump than he was to Hillary Clinton, in my opinion. And so it really shouldn't surprise people that some Bernie voters would want to vote for Trump. Now, as far as why the ideology of morality and Christianity and so forth would go ahead and go to the polls and enthusiastically support Trump, I can only speculate on those people, to be honest with you. But if I may flex the rules a little bit and go ahead and speculate on their opinion, you know, a lot of people compare Trump to Mussolini or Hitler or so on and so forth. I think you got to go a little bit further back and look at Vlad Tepes of Romania, otherwise known as Vlad the Impaler or Vlad Dracula.
Just he FYI, I was going to make the joke. Oh, you're talking about Vlad Dracula, right? I thought that was a joke. You actually are comparing him to Vlad the Impaler. Okay.
Absolutely. Because he ruled over Romania, a Christian kingdom, or he was a prince or whatever he was. And he is, to this very day, a national hero in Romania because he kept the Muslim invaders out of Romania and maintained Romania for Christendom. And so he as an individual can come and go and die and the country lives on today as a, well, Christian nation to whatever extent that you want to call any nation Christian or whatever. And so I think so many of these moral Christian conservatives looked at Donald Trump and said, yeah, I know he's not a Christian. I know he's not a conservative, but he's going to preserve America for Christendom. And that's really the only reason I can speculate for that type of person why they would support Donald Trump.
You know, we really need to get some Trumpists in here because I'll tell you, Justin is one of the more conservative people that I know, and he's over here shaking his head at the idea of Trump being a conservative or a Christian. So we don't really have anybody. Do we know anybody who would stand up for him? We do. This is one guy.
Yeah, we don't want him on the
show. He's not coming back on the show.
But I mean, I wanted to talk about conservatives, and I know that not all conservatives are behind Trump, which is why I differentiated between Trumpism and conservatism. But there is still the fact of the matter that you're, as Daryl said, you're still on the team, and conservatives have said that we are the moral party. That was even in Daryl's introduction, right, about what he sees in conservative leaders that he does not seem to see in liberal leaders. So I think the question still stands whether someone supported Trump or not. The party that they're aligned with did. And so now it's Justin's turn to come up to the microphone on this question. I mean, I know you're shaking your head, but your thoughts on the abandonment of – the seeming abandonment of all morality to vote for someone who stands against your interests and stands against your morality.
Well, I think a vast majority of conservatives did a comparative analysis. They looked at Donald Trump and they said – and looked at Hillary Clinton and went, which one's worse? I think –
People forget that voting for the better of
both
evils,
you're still voting
you're
for
still
evil.
Voting for evil, right?
It's still it was they were both awful and they were both terrible. But for the vast majority of conservatives, Trump was less awful than Clinton was, and I would agree with that. However, conservatives kind of, and I said this right after Trump got elected, they sold their soul to the devil when they voted Trump into the presidency. And I – that was kind of a point in time where I kind of distanced myself a little bit and said I'm more of an independent. I'm not really going to – I've been a Republican, a very straight-line Republican voter for the entirety of my life. And that was kind of the camel that – that was kind of the
camel
straw
that broke the straw's back.
Yeah, straw that broke the camel's back. I was so disenfranchised and so frustrated with the Republican caucus just because they essentially sold their soul to the devil for a victory.
We need a win.
Yeah, we need a win and we need a winner.
Right.
And
they got one.
I'm trying not to growl into the microphone, but
I understand.
It's one of those things where I think that well, and you know, the Democratic Party made it really easy by making Clinton the nominee. I mean, the reality of it is it's just as much the fault of Democrats and the DNC that Trump is in power today as it is the Republicans because the DNC fixed their primaries fixed their primaries to go to Clinton.
I get this.
So if Sanders had won that primary, I can guarantee you right now, Trump would have never even had a sniff of the presidency. Would have never happened.
I'm just going to say, as someone who is more liberal-minded and also just fair-minded, I'm shocked and I'm not shocked. Okay, so I'm not shocked. There was a sketch on Saturday Night Live that had Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock, and they were like, "Oh my God, this is the worst thing that white people have ever done." And they're like, "Really?" And like the black people in the room were just like not shocked at all. They're like, "We've seen this kind of thing happen before," but I don't think that I have ever seen. And again, I'm trying to leave this for conservatives here, but obviously you know my cards and I'm the host, so I can say what I want. I've never seen such buffoonery out of a political candidate that I am shocked that America, the most powerful nation in the world, filled with some of the smartest people in the world, has the best economy in the world, has the strongest – do we have the best economy? One of the best economies in the world. Strongest, largest –
still number one, baby. Right? Yeah. China ain't there yet.
We're doing okay, right? Voted for a man – I look at other presidents, even presidents who have been failures, and I'm like, I can understand how we got there. I am genuinely shocked that people didn't go, okay, this isn't funny anymore. I voted for him originally because it was cool when there were like 8 people on the stage, but now there's only one, and this is it. This isn't funny anymore, America. But we went that way, so I'm shocked in that sense.
You're shocked because you're not. I go to church with the blue collar guy. Okay, these are the people. These are my people.
I stopped going to church with the blue collar guy.
that's one of the reasons why you're shocked.
I was not welcome anymore.
That's one of the reasons you're shocked is because you weren't surrounded by it every day.
No, it's
because
I was black.
The reality of it is,
we can go there. We're gonna go there in the next question.
is the reality of it is that these individuals saw Trump as a breath of fresh air in a political system that they no longer thought was working for them. And in a lot of ways, that thought was justified. They were no longer working for them. They were working for a special interest group, either on the social aspect or on the corporate aspect. It's been a long time, probably a good 20 years, since the political system has worked in favor of the average American.
Let me ask all three of our guests – if you, because the biggest frustration, and I will grant the premise for the moment, I will grant the premise that Hillary Clinton is a moral black hole. I don't agree with that because I think moral black hole is really something you have to reserve for Trump. But
not he doesn't even touch it in comparison to her. Sorry.
Do you recognize that Secretary Clinton, former Secretary Clinton, Senator, whatever title she wants to go with, had a basic level of competence to put together a government that we don't have right now? Had the ability to put together an executive branch that wouldn't be an embarrassment day in and day out?
On the surface, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, on the surface, sure. But behind closed doors, when it came to the policies that she was backing and enacting –
policies are bad. The policies are bad is one thing. But wouldn't you say that policies that you can agree with that cannot be instituted because the people involved are just that sucky at government?
No, well, they're just incompetent.
Right.
Right.
So you
yes, I would rather have someone that I marginally agree with but incompetent to implement that agreement than have someone who has shown herself to be an expert at getting things implemented when I agree with disagree with almost 100% of what she stands for on the policy.
Okay.
So yes, I am definitely – but I didn't vote. I didn't vote in this presidential election. I made it very clear in a post that I wrote on the nerdytheologian.com that – in my view, it was the Christian's responsibility to not vote in this election, to abstain from voting because voting for an evil was still voting for evil.
Okay.
So that was for me the deal.
So let's move forward.
Speaking of Christianity, let's discuss religion for a second. Conservatives have fought for a long time for things like prayer in schools, teaching creationism alongside evolution, like they do in Texas. Nativity scenes on public property at in the Christmas season, and otherwise have baptized America as a Christian nation. What role, Christian or otherwise, should religion play in the shaping of public policy?
I'd just like to give a shout out to Kent, who, when I write questions, reads the questions, pretty much uses all the words that I wrote in the question, but just reorders reorders them. It is a talent that I have noticed that Kent has.
Let me give a shout out to Calvin, who writes questions that sound great on paper, but don't sound like a person when they talk.
You just don't say
so,
it like I do. You just don't say it like I do. Anyway,
I try to make it sound off the cuff and extemporaneous. But what really helps me sound off the cuff and extemporaneous is when we take 2 minutes to point it out. So, but anyway, the question stands.
All right.
But if I may interject this, on that's a good thing that you guys have. That's a chemistry.
We've been doing this for a while.
You know, if I may go to Anchorman, when they said that he would read anything that's on that piece of paper, my co-host, she's reading our outline, and I'm sorry, but I forgot to change it from the last show. And she's reading the guest that we had on the previous show. You know, she would read what's on that piece of paper. So at least you're able to fix it, you know.
That's so funny.
And go F yourself, San Diego.
So, let's discuss religion. What role should it play? Joe, you go first.
This is one of those things I sort of go back and forth about a little bit. And I guess I'll sort of keep my comments pretty minimal and say that I believe that the rights that we have that I keep coming back to all the time are endowed to us by our Creator. And without that sort of axiom to go off of, then I could have all sorts of different philosophies about governance and man's relationship to his fellow man and so on and so forth. So I believe that we were created by God, and as such we were given equal rights from the time of our creation, and we were given a certain birthright as children of God. And so government protecting that is one thing. Now government making laws respecting establishments of religion, as the Constitution says, I think the separation of church and state is a good thing. Even if not to benefit government, but to benefit the church by keeping government out of the church, I think that that's a good thing. But as far as the issue of what role government and religion should play intertwining with each other, that's something I go back and forth on a lot. Though I will say, if you're going to look at limiting government, you're not really looking at eliminating government. What you're doing is taking the onus from an exterior government and replacing it with self-government. Me governing myself, not you governing me, not somebody in Washington, D.C. governing me. And to govern myself, I believe that my Christian faith plays a pivotal role in better self-governance. So I guess from a personal perspective, it plays a role in how I see things, but how the two should, in a very tangible way, intertwine. I guess I sort of prefer the separation of church and state in the way that we really think about it.
Okay. Daryl, what are your thoughts?
I'm looking at it from a different perspective, where when it comes to religion, I call it military religion. I like a religion that tells me what to do, what to think, where to walk, where not to walk. I do best in that area where versus non-denominational, no structure whatsoever, just come to church. Because of that, and I respect a person's religion because all of them have structure, and I'm a structure person. So when it comes to church and state, I just believe, okay, if we're able to have that some type of religion in there, we will have structure. You know, it makes me think of Pink Floyd and the everybody jumping into the falling into the meat grinder because they all look the same or are doing the same thing. But yet and still, I believe in structure. I believe in discipline. So I'm for religion in that perspective in governmental affairs.
So you're saying that religion provides structure to government or there's...
I surely would hope so.
Okay. All right. Justin, thoughts?
All thoughts. So this is where the theologian in me comes out. So keep I have brief, got though, to
we got another big question too.
I've got to really okay. Religion is always going to have a say in public policy. That's not a philosophical point, that's a pragmatic one. Because ethics naturally flow from religious thought or theistic thought. You're always going to have religion interacting with public policy. There's nothing you can do to abstain from that other than, you know, making sure that every single person that's in government is an atheist, which, you know, atheists would like. But
I was just going to say, if you take what some people want to its logical conclusion, it would ensure that the only people eligible for public service are atheists. And I took a breath and you said it. So, okay, it's fine.
So it's one of those things that is a instead of acting like it's not a reality, let's talk about it and deal with it in an honest way. And in my opinion, and my opinion is pretty much summed up by Ben Shapiro's take on this, which is essentially that government is morally and structurally bankrupt without God as a philosophical foundation, especially America. Because the rights that are endowed to us, as Joe said, are endowed to us by our Creator. On a philosophical level, that means that the rights that are given to us by God are objective rights. They're not subjective rights. They're not rights that we can choose not to give each other when we so choose to. They're rights that are owed to us because God gave them to us. And in the American system, where liberty is really kind of the stalwart of what it means to be American, you cannot have that without some form of theistic religious thinking.
Worth noting for this conversation, by the way, that Ben Shapiro is an Orthodox Jew.
Yes.
So it's not like he's a Christian warrior.
No, he's not a Christian. No. He's an Orthodox Jew, but his argument with regard to this is a very good epistemological argument. And that is kind of somewhere that's one of the areas wheelhouses of philosophy that I kind of worked through in my master's program. So, you know, that's something that he does incredibly well. But I think it's something that's always going to be an issue. And I think some of these issues like public property, nativity scenes on public property, something like that needs to be municipal. Federal and state governments have no right to be putting their face into anything there. Because some people are going to – some communities are going to consider that an exercise of their religion. So, you're not going to see a nativity scene up in Dearborn because, A, the vast majority of the populace in Dearborn is Muslim. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't see a nativity scene in
– Montgomery, Alabama.
Alabama.
First thing to come to
mind. There you go. So, I mean, that's part of what makes culture in this country fascinating is the fact that you can go from one place to another and there's diametric shifts in culture based on the populace that you have there. I think that when we try to neuter that, what we're really doing is killing what makes America great.
So do you think America needs to be made great again? Go on, but moving on.
So let's talk about killing. By the way, let's talk about Black Lives Matter. This, and I'll just be honest. This is one of the, I think, a lot of responses to violence against black and brown bodies by the police force, and the increased militarization of the police force in the United States is, and the response to that by government officials and by conservatives was kind of like the nail in the coffin for my conservatism. Like, I'm a guest, and I am an unwelcome guest is how I felt. But let's talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. Since its inception, a lot of conservatives I know have characterized Black Lives Matter as, okay, it's reverse racist, or it is it's anti-police. Some have even called Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. I've seen a lot of stories about this. I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center had to come out and explain why Black Lives Matter and the KKK are not synonymous with each other. But what are the main issues conservatives have with groups like Black Lives Matter, and why also the conflation of Black Lives Matter with and their nonviolent action movement? If you go to their site and you hear from their leadership, it is a nonviolent action movement, just like Martin Luther King's movement was. Why the conflation with the direct action of loosely configured groups like Antifa, which showed up in Charlottesville, which is far left leaning, direct action, which means that they do violent things on the far left side of things. But why the conflation of a group that's nonviolent with a group that is violent? Why is that a thing? What are the issues of Black Lives Matter, and why the conflation with groups that are actually violent? And Daryl, I want you to take this first, because you're conservative and you're black. And so I know that can be a very big, and you're willing to say it, right?
Absolutely.
So what are the issues? I mean, do you find yourself in agreement with conservatives who say things about Black Lives Matter, or? And how do you feel about it as a conservative?
I am a realist, and I, because of my complexion, I can go in those doors. That doesn't mean that I'm in agreement with what's going on. People in Black Lives Matter, is there some racism in there? Absolutely. It can be camouflaged, but it's a subtle type of racism. I always looked at it like, when it's benefiting you, you don't really have an issue. We got BET, we got black beauty pageants and all this kind of stuff. When it's benefiting you, you don't see anything wrong with it. But what if I was white and I'm like, well, why do they have this and why do they have this? And when you have something like Black Lives Matter, it makes me think that if I was a white person, my life doesn't matter. So I will more so support the whole, I think it says all lives matter. Okay, you know, I understand what's going on with police brutality. A lot of times, and I'll get crucified for saying this, a lot of times black people were doing something that they had no business doing. They weren't respecting the authority of the law. I can't explain all of them, but some of them were questionable. So trying to stay on subject, I would not wear a Black Lives Matter shirt, put it that way.
So, all right. So let me just, I got to ask. So the African-American, the African Methodist Episcopal Church exists. I don't know. Do you know why that church exists?
Enlighten me.
After slavery, white masters no longer wanted, they had their slaves that would sit up in the upper balcony. That's where they put them. Right. After slavery was ended, they kicked them all out of the church. Right. We don't want you in our congregation. So then you had African-Americans who no longer had a church home, who created their own, and they moved along a different theological trajectory. And so years later, we've got these segregated churches because we were kicked out. So when you look at things like BET, and I can go round and round about the shit that BET puts out, right? Should it or shouldn't? BET is no different than a CBS or an ABC putting out shit that people shouldn't be watching, right? But the fact of the matter is, black people weren't welcome. They weren't represented in Hollywood. They were underrepresented. So we created our own network. We created our own net worth.
I agree with that. Right?
So black beauty pageants. because white women are the standard of beauty, we have to create our own pageants. So when you look at Black Lives Matter, I don't understand the white reaction. I also don't understand how you don't hear it as a black person. And I want you to push back on this, but no one is saying that other people's lives don't matter too, or only my life matters. And the reason why you know this is true is because Blue Lives Matter happened, right? Oh, we're pro-cop. Well, no one, when Blue Lives Matter came out, thought, well, you're only saying that cops' lives matter. Nobody thought that. So Black Lives Matter is Black Lives Matter too. All lives matter. Yes, we know all lives matter, but this is about Black Lives Matter at this point, because the judicial system apparently doesn't know that Black Lives Matter. Police force apparently doesn't know that Black Lives Matter. So we're letting you know Black Lives Matter too. Just as much as Asian life, just as much as a white life, just as much as Hispanic life, it matters. So I don't understand the jump to, well, I don't see for – I mean, you're like defending white people's response to it. Well, my life doesn't matter. You're saying my life doesn't matter. Yes, your life matters. We know your life matters. You're not the issue right now. The issue is black and brown bodies are being shot and killed at an alarming rate by the police department. We're not anti-cop. We are anti-police shooting unarmed civilians, most of whom are black.
Your points, I fully understand. And going to the black thing in the 70s, I can understand the black beauty pageant. But if we're supposed to be so evolved, I don't know if it's necessary now. But going to the Black Lives Matter, if Black Lives Matter, it's so important, why wouldn't the black president have more involvement in it? I don't think that Obama did anything for Black Lives Matter, nor black people. So that's where I have the concern. That's where I have the concern.
Okay. Justin?
Well, first I'd like to preface what I'm about to say with, I love you, Calvin.
No, I'm going to go.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm just going to go.
And what's funny about this is that until I really started to dig in deep and get into the statistics of all of this, I was kind of pulled over to the side of BLM. But as I began to do more and more research into the statistical findings and what was going on, I realized that black people kind of hitch their wagon to a statistical misnomer. 5.42% of the black populace was shot by police. Some of them shot, you know, they should have been shot because they had guns. Some of them not. That's 5.42%, okay, in the year of 2016. When you look at the number of people, I think the issue that a lot of whites have with regard to the issue of Black Lives Matter is that it doesn't seem and white people in a lot of sense don't have any – are hypocrites for saying this because they are no – they're 2% better, okay? They're 2% better. But when the number of people killed in this country by – way of unnatural homicide death, 90% are killed by other black people. Now, whites are killed by 88% of other whites, okay? So 88% of the people, white people who are killed in this country are killed by other whites. 90% of the people, black people killed in this country are killed by other blacks. So it's a 2% difference, okay? But the problem is that you're taking a – what is a statistical blip – and making it something – you're conflating it to something that it isn't. It's not an epidemic. It's not something that is a – it's not something that is occurring at a drastic rate. Last year we had 963 police shootings. We had 963 people killed. 233 of those were black. 483 of them were white, okay? Now, when you look at the statistics between the ratios, more black people were killed than white people. I think 1.87% of white people, Okay. When you look at the statistic of the people, white people killed versus the white population in this country.
Important that the listener knows that Justin is not reading statistics. He has memorized every number he's saying. I stood up and I looked, does he have notes?
Nope.
Nope. No. And because this is an important issue to me because right. You're important to me. So yes. It, for me, it was an issue of, I really want to make sure I have my ducks in a row here.
Now, let me push back real quick and then I'll let you continue. The only thing I want to push back on is the conflation of black on black, white on white crime, whatever, with police brutality. Those are, I don't think the black on black crime, which isn't a thing, by the way, because most people kill people from their own community.
Right. That was okay. The reason for me right. Giving that statistic right. About
so
whites.
That is often brought in to this conversation. Those are totally separate conversations. And that's normally brought – you're not doing it right now, but people will bring, oh, well, you know what? Black people are killing more black people, so why don't you guys do anything about that? Look, we have plenty of organizations that are talking about that and dealing with that in our own house. What we are talking about right now is police brutality.
Right.
Okay, so whether the number is 5% or 90%, more than right. 0% is too much.
I think the problem, Kelvin, is that BLM has moved past that, though, in a lot of ways.
I don't think that it has moved past
that. No,
I
mean, you haven't.
No,
you haven't.
In any of their official meetings, any of their official writings, any of the official leadership, it has not.
I think that if BLM was what you believe it is –
BLM
I wouldn't have an issue with
BLM
it.
BLM is exactly officially.
Right.
Is
the official version of what it is.
The exact same thing that Martin Luther King's
but the
movement
reality,
was.
I know. But the reality of it is that when it comes to the common people, that's not what it is. Well, you're an intellectual, Calvin.
Well, to the common people, Martin Luther King walking across an Edmund Pettus Bridge was a violent act, right?
Okay? Well, to common white people, yeah.
To most people at the time. Yeah. Why didn't they stay home? Why are they snarling traffic? That is the exact same response that Black Lives Matter is getting. And they are getting compared to the KKK, and they're getting compared to Antifa.
Right.
If you want to talk about groups that are violent, fine, talk about groups that are violent. But don't, for the purpose of a narrative, and you're not doing it right now, but I'm seeing this only within conservatism, making to conflate Black Lives Matter with the Ku Klux Klan
yeah.
is morally wrong.
Right. And I don't disagree with you with the official movement. I think the issue is that a lot of conservatives are not referencing the official movement, which they're doing an awful job articulating. Okay. Now, granted, that they're doing an absolutely horrific job articulating that. They're talking about issues like at Mizzou, where the president of Mizzou was fired for supposedly running over a black kid when all of the evidence seemed to show that this kid had essentially laid down in front of the car and acted like he was hurt. Okay. And then you've got the issue of the school in Washington. The name of the school is escaping right now, where they essentially took the entire university hostage. Okay. That's who these people, when you hear conservatives talk about BLM, that's what they're referencing. They're not referencing the movement that you're talking about. Okay. Because that movement in and of, and even though I think it's a statistical blip, in a lot of ways there's credence to what they're saying, because it is, you know me with police brutality, I'm not a big fan of police brutality. On many podcasts that you and I have done together, I have talked about how police brutality and the militarization of the
yes.
police is a serious issue in this country.
But there's no reason that I should accept as valid an argument from groups who are not willing to do the work, who want to keep it surface level. Hey, they took this group hostage because one guy yelled Black Lives Matter. So even though I know that the official movement is nonviolent over here, and this is what the leaders say, and they've condemned what's happening over there at Washington State University, I'm going to conflate that. That's like someone saying, hey, you know what? Christianity is bunk because, you know, Westboro Baptist is out there
right.
picketing these right. these funerals.
No, I agree.
It sounds to me, if I don't misunderstand, Justin, the way you're describing it is that conservatives, or at least a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
are viewing any black activism as Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
That they're conflating them together.
Positive, negative. I mean, it's all of that wrapped into one. And I think that that's part of the problem, is there's some dishonesty in the commentary going on in the conservative movement. And even guys like Ben Shapiro and Andrew Klavan and those guys have been, you know, guilty of this. And I really like Shapiro and I really like Andrew Klavan, but I think in the sense of those particular issues that they are off base. But I also think that the left has done the same thing with the alt-right, because the alt-right wasn't originally a white supremacist movement. It was originally just a bunch of guys on the internet who were essentially trolling social justice warriors. These were people who were sick and tired of the political correct culture. These were people who were sick and tired of feeling like they were being muzzled and hamstrung every time they said a word. That's what the alt-right was at the beginning. When the media started coverage of this thing, they began wrapping this thing into, well, this is really white supremacist, is really white. And then guys like Richard Spencer and all those dirtbags started coming out of the woodwork. Really started coining the phrases.
Let Milo Yiannopoulos.
Milo? Yeah, but Milo was one of the big reasons why the alt-right got off the ground and was so popular, especially with young conservatives. But the reality of it is
a little bit of Steve Bannon.
Yeah. But I think you know, but what's interesting is that now that it's really been articulated as more of a white supremacist movement, Milo's moved away from it. He's essentially disowned it. He said it was just these 200 people in the backwaters of Louisiana that nobody cared about, but all of a sudden the alt-right really has become this white supremacist dangerous movement, and I want nothing to do with it. And so it's one of those things where, you know, unfortunately he's kind of been like pigeonholed into that now because he was kind of one of the large presenters of the alt-right, even though, you know, the alt-right at the time wasn't what they are now.
Milo doesn't help himself by dressing like a stereotypical Nazi at every single opportunity.
Well, he's gay, so he does and flamboyantly so. Mm-hmm. So he does dress himself
so
terribly.
So we're running out of time. We're meandering a little. Joe, give some final thoughts on this question, then we have to wrap up, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, on a broad level, I think part of the problem that conservatives have with Black Lives Matter is that any time you start talking about group rights, that's sort of an affront to one of the pillars of conservatism, which is individual rights, and that the smallest minority on earth is the individual. And so I think when you start talking in a group-type language, conservatives are naturally bothered by it. It hits one of their core pillars. But you know, the reality is police brutality is a serious problem in this country across the spectrum, but the criminal justice system as a whole, I'll just say, is slanted against people of color, particularly with the war on drugs and what they choose to implement, you know, mandatory minimums for and what they don't and so on and so forth. But let's not forget that police officers are the enforcers of the state. You know, that's what they are. So this really shouldn't be a black person versus white person issue, when in reality it should be individuals versus the power of the government. You know, the Eric Garner situation is the one that always springs to mind for me, because here's a guy who was smuggling cigarettes to avoid, you know, local tobacco taxes. And he got killed by the enforcers of the government. And so the libertarian in me always looks at that and says, I mean, the issue here is government power more than anything else. That's what it comes down to, I think.
Okay. Well, I could go much longer. We had a few questions that we didn't get to ask, but I know we will be having these guests back on in the very near future, a couple weeks from now. I believe, Justin, you're going to be back on our panel a couple weeks from now.
Yep.
Unless you have to give me bad news right now.
No, I'll be here.
So you'll be on our Moving Beyond Identity Politics, which that particular episode is actually coming out of private conversations that you and I have had.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank our panelists for being here. And for those of you listening, of course, thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and the last two seasons now. Bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating, that's very important. And tune in next week where Kent and I continue our 3-week political series, Divided States of America, with a panel titled, Why I Am Liberal. See you next week.